Okay. First, I'd like to thank all of you for attending. We're very pleased to connect with you because you make our work possible. For today's webinar, we'll be sharing some arresting facts about the connections between our energy use and water resources. We'll be addressing some surprising connections, dangerous risks, and potential solutions to the energy-water collision as UCS staff share early findings from their three-year initiative, Energy and Water in a Warming World. John Rogers, Senior Analyst with UCS, will present, along with SACE's High Risk Energy Choice Program Director, Sarah Barzak. For those of you who are not familiar with SACE, we are a regional organization with offices across the Southeast. For over 25 years, we've been a leading advocate for clean, responsible energy choices at the federal, state, and local levels. I will now be turning the presentation over to John Rogers, Senior Analyst with UCS. John?
Thank you very much, Courtney, and thank you to SACE for hosting this important webinar. I'd like to start by telling you just a little bit about how the information in this webinar came about, and then quickly walk you through some of the points before I turn it over to Sarah Barzak of SACE. And I'll say right off the bat, apologies from Erica Spanger Siegfried, who is out sick today. So I will be I'll be doing our part of the presentation by myself. So my name is John Rogers, and I'm a senior energy analyst with UCS's Climate and Energy Program. UCS, just briefly, is the leading science-based nonprofit working for a healthy environment and a safer world. What we do is combine independent scientific research and citizen action to develop innovative practical solutions and to secure responsible changes in government policy, corporate practices, and consumer choices. As Courtney said, last year we launched an initiative to look at the water implications of our energy choices. That Energy and Water in a Warming World initiative adds a new dimension to our years of work on electricity and transportation fuels and on climate science and climate solutions. In our research into energy water issues, as we first focused on this, we came across a number of noteworthy, even startling figures, surprising even to us as people who have been working on related issues for a number of years. So our 10 things document, for which there'll be a link on the website, it's a collection aimed at presenting some of those figures as a way of shedding light on many of the dimensions of the energy water collision. Some of these will be familiar to some of you, others less so. What we hope is that this brief presentation and our work will help to advance the discussion about some of the issues and how people are talking about them. So as it turns out, water and energy are intertwined in a whole lot of ways. Producing energy uses water, and providing fresh water uses energy. Both these processes face growing limits and problems. In terms of water use for electricity production, just a very brief recap of the basics. Most of the power plants in the U.S. make electricity from steam, so boiling water by burning coal or natural gas, say, or through nuclear reactions. The steam then drives a steam turbine to generate electricity. That steam then needs to be cooled down. How the plants use water to cool the steam and how much water they use varies. Many power plants, particularly older ones, withdraw lots of water, use it once, and then dump almost all of it back into the river or lake that they got it from. This is called once-through cooling, and over two-fifths of U.S. power plants use this approach. Other plants reuse the cooling water until it gets used up through evaporation. Those plants withdraw just a fraction of the water that once-through plants do, but consume more of the water that they take in. Altogether, those plants add up to some serious water use. Considering fresh water alone, plants withdrew an average of 143 billion gallons per day in 2009. So that's about 140 times as much as New York City uses each day. To bring that down to the personal level, if you consider an average family of four, that family uses 400 gallons of fresh water per day for all of its needs. Assuming its home is powered by a coal-fired or nuclear-powered plant that takes fresh water for once-through cooling, that family indirectly uses several times that amount, 600 to 1,800 gallons, through power plant water withdrawals. So that's putting water use in a whole different light. Another way to understand water use by power plants is to think about it in the context of our water use across the board. Nationally, the amount of fresh water withdrawn to cool power plants is roughly the same as that for crop irrigation. In the Southeast, though, electricity's water withdrawals easily top agriculture's. Power plants there withdraw an average of 40 billion gallons of fresh water every day, or 65% of the region's total. You can think about this lower demand. Clearly, part of that has to do with how we use water, how water is used in the Southeast, the lower demand for irrigating crops. But several Southeast states, Tennessee, North Carolina, and South Carolina, have the nation's highest total withdrawals for power plants. Water quantity is certainly not the only issue with the water implications of our electricity use. Water quality can also be a big one. One aspect of that, but just one, is water temperature. So water discharge from a coal plant is hotter by an average of 17 degrees Fahrenheit than when it entered the plant. Half of all coal plants in the U.S. report releasing water in the summer at peak temperatures of 100 degrees Fahrenheit or more. So this thermal pollution can stress or kill fish and other wildlife. On the Chattahoochee River in Georgia, for example, several thousand fish died each summer until Georgia Power retrofitted its coal-fired plants with cooling towers in 2002. The Brayton Point coal plant, shown here in Somerset, Massachusetts, is in the process of building cooling towers to substantially reduce the amount of water it needs to draw in and reduce its water impact. And it was pressured to do that because of the impact it was having on the local, the serious impacts it was having on the local water system. And this isn't just an issue for fresh water. Putting power plants on our coast deals with some of the problems, but discharging warm seawater can similarly harm local marine ecosystems. It's also important to understand that the energy-water collision isn't just a problem for fish. So even if you don't care about fish, you need to consider that water troubles can shut down power plants themselves. Higher water temperatures can mean less efficient plant operation, which affects the economics of running a plant. They can also mean that the plant can't safely run at all. Just since 2004, water stress has led at least a dozen power plants to temporarily dial down or shut down completely, and prompted a number of states to deny new power plant proposals. One glaring example in the Southeast is the Browns Ferry nuclear plant in Athens, Alabama, pictured here. During prolonged heat this summer, for example, water temperatures in the Tennessee River hit 90 degrees Fahrenheit. Browns Ferry significantly cut the power output of all three of its reactors for nearly five consecutive weeks, all while cities in the region were experiencing high power demands for air conditioning. Increasing energy efficiency, using more efficient appliances, buildings, cars, and trucks, allows us to meet our energy needs with less electricity and therefore with less water use at power plants. Shifting to certain renewable energy technologies, such as wind turbines and solar photovoltaic modules, means generating electricity with essentially no water at all. But water usage by other renewable energy options varies widely. Technologies that use steam to generate electricity need to cool that steam. Those include bioenergy, geothermal, and concentrating solar power, such as the plant shown here. So it's important to remember that clean energy can mean low carbon and low water or not. Some concentrating solar plants use far less water per unit of energy than a typical coal or nuclear plant to cool steam. Others use more than coal or nuclear plants. So as we increase our use of renewable energy, something we very much hope and fully expect will happen for a whole host of reasons, the water implications are another dimension that we should be paying attention to. The energy-water collision and our energy-water initiative extend far beyond power plants. Transportation fuels also have varying degrees of water implications. If you think about the water footprint of conventional biofuels, such as corn ethanol, for example, those can be huge. If you power your car with ethanol, you may use dozens of gallons of water per mile. And this has to do with irrigation. So creating a single gallon of ethanol consumes on average of about 100 gallons of fresh water, but in some regions, ethanol production can take three or more times that amount, mostly depending on water needs for irrigation. But other approaches use a lot less, using cellulosic biofuels, for example. You wouldn't run a car on straight ethanol, but just to give you a sense of the implications of putting ethanol in your tank, there's this graph here. If you were to run a typical car on corn ethanol, it would require 1/2 to 20 gallons of water per mile or more, depending on the water used for irrigation. Cellulosic biofuel would require less than a gallon per mile, and gasoline, while not a renewable resource, requires the least water, less than half a gallon for extracting and refining the oil. I focus this talk so far on the water implications of our energy, of our electricity, our energy production, but there's also the equally important flip side. So just as energy production requires large amounts of water, pumping, transporting, treating, heating water, the water we use every day can involve substantial amounts of energy. Nationwide, the EPA estimates treating and distributing drinking water and wastewater together account for 3% of energy use, and in some parts of the country, the energy toll is much higher. California, for example, uses nearly 20% of its electricity and more than 30% of its natural gas for water. The state's single biggest user of electricity is the State Water Project. So this is the graphic about to come up there is a slide from the California Energy Commission. Please don't try to read it. I just want to illustrate the complexity of this slide and use that to illustrate the complexity of this side of the energy-water collision, the challenges, all the places where energy comes into play in water systems. Most people in this country, when they see something about water unrest, as you see here, or water supply conflicts, would think about the West and Southwest, and there's certainly plenty to think of there. But most people outside of this call probably wouldn't realize that it's not an issue that's confined to arid regions, even if that's no surprise to people, to you all. Many of you would remember the recent droughts in the Southeast, for example, and the disputes that were simmering between Georgia, Tennessee, and other stakeholders over the rights to the Tennessee River water in 2008. These are photos from Lake Hiawassee in Georgia during that drought. Water is an issue that pits the demands of cities against those of farmers, against those of utilities and their power plants. And we've got U.S. government projections that have electricity capacity growing significantly between now and 2030, 10% in the Southeast and nearly 30% in the Western U.S. Those are just projections, and reality is something different. But any thought of expanding our energy infrastructure in the old ways really forces the question, with what water? That the energy-water collision is something that's starkly apparent to people in some parts of the U.S., and it will likely become increasingly apparent to an even broader portion of our population. And then there are the issues of climate change and climate variability. Increasing climate variability, whether that's extreme heat or extended drought or other manifestations, is already testing the resilience of energy and water systems in the southwestern U.S. and other regions. Further climate change will pose even farther reaching challenges. And those will be different challenges in different parts of the country. More runoff in some places, less in others, more precipitation, less precipitation. In the Southeast, scientists expect both air and water temperatures to rise. That means the cases of the water being too warm to be used to cool power plants may become a lot more frequent. So the isolated cases we're seeing now, like the Browns Ferry nuclear plant, could rise to a much more significant level. And nationally, the net effect of climate change will be a more variable and unreliable water situation. But the energy water story doesn't have to be one with a bad ending. As important as understanding the dimensions of the collision is understanding the range of solutions. There are energy technologies that use essentially no water for electricity production. I already mentioned wind and solar photovoltaics, for example, and energy efficiency. Energy efficiency, which saves money and reduces global warming pollution and other pollutants, but also eliminates the corresponding water use at the power plants that are no longer needed. There are also low water energy technology options. Shifting old coal or nuclear plants from once through cooling to more water efficient closed loop cooling technologies would increase water consumption, potentially even doubling it, but would reduce water withdrawals by two orders of magnitude. And there are also dry and hybrid cooling options that help address water consumption. Those kinds of technologies could be particularly important in regions that are severely water constrained. It's important to consider, though, that those kinds of options reduce the efficiency of the power plants and increase their costs. And in the case of coal plants, for example, they don't do anything to deal with the carbon pollution. For biofuels, we can minimize reliance on irrigation, switch to low water perennial crops or even to waste products to lower the water requirements and improve their carbon performance. Several steps can be taken to reduce the water demand of some renewable energy options, concentrating solar plants, for example, which are ideally sited in some of the country's sunniest and driest locations, are increasingly turning to dry cooling despite the higher costs. So let me conclude by reiterating that there are many dimensions to the energy-water collision, only some of which I've touched on here. There are serious challenges, but there are also opportunities to deal with those challenges. Ignoring either the challenges or the opportunities isn't the constructive way forward. A number of organizations are working on important facets of this issue. The goal of UCS's Energy and Water in a Warming World initiative is exploring and informing different energy and electricity pathways. We believe that if we are aware of the water dimensions, we as a society will make different decisions about the way we make and use energy. We do have choices for the sake of our economy and our environment, for making sure we have power when we want it and minimize the impact of our energy use on our surroundings. Making choices based on our understanding of the water implications is key. In the spirit of that quest for understanding, I'd like to turn the microphone over now to Sarah Barzac from SACE to try to put an even more solid face on some of these issues through a look at the challenges and opportunities in one particular state. Sarah.
Thank you, John. That was really interesting. My name is Sarah Barzac, the Program Director of Southern Alliance for Clean Energy's High-Risk Energy Choices Program. Thanks again to all of you for joining us today, for UCS joining us, and for Courtney Darrow, our staffer, who is doing a great job on the technical side of this. We wanted to bring it closer to home, in this case, spotlighting water planning that's underway in Georgia. And I just have a few slides to illustrate the issues going on the ground there. This first slide sort of reiterates some of what John had said earlier. In Georgia, like many of the states across the country, and especially in the Southeast, the energy sector is the largest water use sector. It's followed by agriculture in Georgia. I have a statistic there that shows that more than half of the total surface water use in the state was used by power plants. Of course, some of this is consumed primarily as evaporative loss that occurs during the cooling process. And in 2005, those were the numbers used for energy forecasting and water planning in Georgia. The link is there on that slide. You can see it. But in 2005, about 187 million gallons per day was consumed, or about 7% of total water withdrawals. Next slide, please. Unfortunately, Georgia is, if things move forward as the way many utilities and proponents of water-intensive energy choices hope, we will have a very water-intensive energy future on the horizon. There are, unfortunately, three new coal plants proposed in Georgia. I have those listed here. That is obviously not good for climate change. Global warming issues, certainly not good for public health. And given our presentation today, it's not good for water quality or water use. The plants listed here are sort of in an order of which ones are furthest along in the permitting process. Ben Hill, the third one listed here, being the most recent proposal. Georgia also, unfortunately, has two new reactors proposed at the existing plant Vogtle. That is an endeavor being pursued by Southern Company through their subsidiary, Georgia Power, NEAG, Oglethorpe Power, and Dalton Utilities. Those two proposed new reactors would be looking at pulling an additional 53 to 83 million gallons of water per day from the Savannah River, with an estimated 50 to 75% consumptive loss. To put that consumptive water loss in perspective, this means that the two existing Vogtle reactors and the two proposed reactors could use enough water to supply 1.4 to 2.3 million Georgians. So it's a tremendous amount of water, and as you can see here, if all of these proposals go forward, it has serious implications for our water resources in Georgia. Next slide, please. Thank you. Statewide water planning has been underway in Georgia for a number of years. A state law was passed in 2008 requiring that to happen, and we're actually nearing the close of its first planning phase. The plan did establish a regional planning process and developed 11 planning regions throughout the state. They are roughly based on river basins. Unfortunately, they did merge some of the basins in somewhat unusual ways and also took into some political boundaries into account. So it's not the perfect way to be divvied up, but it is better, you know, than it could have been. I pulled a quote from the plan itself that illustrates what its purpose is. It's really to guide Georgia in managing water resources in a sustainable manner. And a key element of this planning process is the assessment of current water use and forecasted needs. And so the next slide, please. Next slide here on energy forecasting talks about one of the largest water use sectors. Energy forecasting is one that had to be done for the water planning process. Others were, for instance, agricultural forecasting, you know, how much water is foreseen to be needed through to 2050 for the agricultural sector in Georgia, which is second in water use to energy. This energy forecasting was late in coming. It was finally released at the end of October. I do want to thank the Environmental Protection Division of Georgia, who leads the effort in the water planning process. I mean, there's a lot of work that had to be done that they've attempted to tackle. There is a lot of good information in the energy forecasting. The link to that is there at the bottom of the slide. But there are some serious flaws, some glaring problems that we have noticed in the energy forecasting. We hope to do, and I'm sure allies on the phone here hope to do, a much more intensive review of it. But essentially, it's presenting only high-growth, high-water use scenarios. It's looking at a business-as-usual approach, essentially assuming that the power plants listed in my earlier slides are built, and that Georgia just sort of stays on its, you know, more coal, more nuclear, more fossil fuel of kick. And then they also have, when you look into further down the road from 2021 to 2050, they're actually estimating 1,000 megawatts of additional capacity will be added every year, which, I'm sorry, just to use some simple language, but is insane. I mean, that is essentially a new reactor coming online every year, or a large new coal plant coming online every year. The water implications of that are tremendous. The energy forecasting overlooks less water-intensive energy demand, energy supply options and measures to increase demand. So there is really no scenario when you download this forecasting document. There's no forecasting scenario that says, for instance, what if we reduced energy demand in Georgia by 20% by 2050 or something like that? What if we increased renewable, low water intensive renewables to 15% by a certain year? And really what you walk away from with the energy forecasting when you read through the document is it just feels like electric utilities are laying claim to Georgia's water resources. They're positioning themselves to be the first, highest, and best use of the water. And I think many of the other large water users would argue, well, agriculture, for instance, pumps a huge amount of money into the Georgia economy. They want to make sure they have their resources. Municipalities and drinking water needs, I think many of us on the phone would think drinking water needs should be looked at as a highest and best use. The other thing that we notice in energy forecasting is that several power plant scenarios were overlooked or ignored. For instance, the Ben Hill coal plant that I mentioned earlier in a slide that's proposed, they didn't include that in the forecast, yet it is a real proposal. We think that should be in there. Also, out-of-state power plants were not always considered, even though they were pulling from Georgia's water resources. For instance, the Southern Company's Plant Farley in Alabama, also Southern Company's Plant Schultz down in Florida, for instance. There are also technologies likely to be implemented in the future at existing coal plants that are more water intensive. Carbon capture and sequestration, which is likely to be needed to deal with climate change, could increase water consumption by 80 to 100%. And flue gas desulfurization units are being added to coal plants. That could increase consumption by 10%. And then a glaring oversight, which John touched on in one of his slides, is that climate change is not considered. The reality is we are likely to face more serious and long-lasting droughts in Georgia and the Southeast, and those implications are not looked at this energy forecasting, which is supposed to look outward to 2050. Next slide, please. So, what to do? Well, obviously, if you're in Georgia or concerned about Georgia, we want you to get involved with statewide water planning. Many other states also are engaged in some aspect of water planning. So for you, for those of you outside of Georgia or the region, see what is happening in your state and see whether or not energy has been brought onto the table. In Georgia, the regional water councils, they just received an extension. They have until early May of 2011 to complete their plans. The good news is there are several additional meetings that the councils will hold. The website listed there, georgiawaterplanning.org, has the details. We'd encourage those of you that can to attend the meetings, talk to the council members. You can also, you don't have to talk to the council members just there at the meeting. You can write them letters or get a hold of them over the phone, share your concerns with them. Thankfully, there will, according to the Environmental Protection Division, there will be a 45-day public comment period after the initial draft plans are submitted to EPD. So we should all be prepared to offer careful review and comment on these important documents. Certainly for those of you outside of the region that may be concerned about Georgia and the implications of its plan, if you have success stories or interesting things from your state, that feel free to help us out and help Georgia have a better plan. And lastly, if you have questions and you want other ways to get involved, you can contact me. My email address is listed there. Or get engaged with the Georgia Water Coalition. SACE is a member of that, as are probably many of you on the phone. It's an excellent, diverse, large coalition that was organized many years ago, actually, to specifically deal with water planning. Their website is georgiawater.org. You can find lots of good information there. And I want to thank, again, all of you for being here. I want to thank UCS and, again, Courtney Darrow for helping run a smooth webinar. And lastly, and Courtney does have a concluding slide, but lastly, SACE is celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. So please consider supporting our organization so we can help do many more webinars in the future. Thank you, and now back to Courtney.
Well, thank you, Sarah and John. This has been a great presentation. We are going to open it up for question and answer session at this point. I want to orient everyone with the control panel on the right-hand side of your screen. Questions are going to be answered in the order they come in. If you have a question specifically for Sarah or for John, please specify in your statement. For the first question, why does a plant shut down when the source water is warm? Is the source water too hot to effectively cool?
So maybe I'll, this is John, maybe I'll take that one. It depends. Sometimes when the water's coming in, it's less effective at cooling. That makes the plant more expensive to run, which means other plants run instead. Other times, there is an issue with how effectively it's cooling, but there's also an issue with how hot the water is when it's being discharged. So if that plant isn't allowed to discharge water above a certain temperature, let's say 90 or 95 degrees, and the water is at that temperature when it's coming into the plant, then obviously, if you think about the laws of thermodynamics, it can't do a whole lot with that water. So they're forced to seek other sources of power for that time period.
And this is Sarah. John had a slide and mentioned Grom's Ferry, TVA's nuclear plant down in Alabama. In that instance, it was having to power back significantly for a much longer period of time than they anticipated because they were about to be in violation of their water permit. And I think the temperature limit they had was 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 94 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that. So if they had continued operating, they would have then violated their permit. And I did want to highlight with that because TVA was had to power that back in the summer. They had to obviously find power elsewhere, and there are rate payer impacts to these issues. We focus today a lot on the environmental side of it, but, you know, if a power plant that is fairly efficient economically to run has to power back and they have to go elsewhere, the odds are the power that they're going to buy is more expensive, and so you know, looking at less water-intensive energy options in the future is also something that will provide our belief more reliable power that is also more reliable in terms of the cost you're going to be paying for it, because it's not going to experience some of these interruptions due to drought or other things.
And that's a great point, Sarah. And we, as Sarah said, we haven't talked about the economic dimensions. As I mentioned in my presentation, you know, at this point, we can go elsewhere. You know, a TVA would go somewhere else to get the energy it needs to supply customers. But if we see an escalation, as we fully expect, if the energy-water collision is getting worse, if we're not proactive about addressing the water use of our power plants, then at some point that may not be an option at a key juncture.
In the same vein, another question is, isn't there a requirement that power plants can't discharge water any more than 2 degrees above the temperature in the body of water that they're discharging?
I don't know if there's a hard and fast rule. I know it's power plant specific in terms of the discharge permits that Sarah was mentioning. And those have to do with the environmental requirements of the body of water. So if you think about the type of fish, the ecosystem there, and what temperatures and for what duration that ecosystem is likely to withstand. That's where those come in.
next question.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that restriction. It again, on a power plant basis, obviously that wasn't the case in Alabama because the Tennessee River is not 88 degrees on a regular basis, at least. But that would certainly be something, again, to look at in the future is, you know, the regulatory environment and making sure that thermal discharge is protective of the water systems, especially as we look towards the fact that we are likely to have droughts and thus lower flow likely means higher temperatures and their implications there.
And here again, it's, as Sarah was saying, it's about the economics. If you think about it, I mean, we care about fish for the sake of the fish. We also care about the fish for the sake of the economy that they support. You know, the people who depend on that for their livelihood, and so that's, it's not some this is not divorced from the economics of the power plants and their water use.
Thank you. The next question is for Sarah. Why such a big consumptive loss for the two new Vogtle reactors compared to existing generation capacity in Georgia?
Well, the new, the proposed reactors are the Toshiba Westinghouse AP1000 design, and most of you may be aware that that has not yet been built anywhere in the world. China is building one now, and obviously Plant Vogtle is trying to move forward on that and are the lead new reactor project in the United States. But that's the estimated water use as provided in the permitting documents. The existing reactors are pretty consumptive as well. I mean, they pull approximately 64 million gallons or so, and they're consuming about 43 million gallons. So they're returning roughly only about a third of what they're withdrawing from the Savannah River now. So the AP1000 reactors are a little bit more water intensive. But nuclear plants with cooling towers or cooling systems are one of the most water consuming energy supply options out there. There's an excellent report, a 2006 Department of Energy report to Congress on the connection between energy and water, and there's an excellent chart in it that lists out essentially every kind of power supply that's out there, including some of the newer forms of renewables, and you'll see that nuclear power with cooling systems is one of the most water intensive. And unfortunately, Georgia as a state and the Southeast as a region has a number of new reactor proposals, which is very problematic for our water resources.
And you can find links in our in the 10 things document on our website. You can find links to that Department of Energy report and other useful materials.
Okay, next, I think this is more of okay. The next question is this person would like to have rainwater harvesting included among the energy water collision solutions. Can you talk about rainwater harvesting?
I can touch on it just briefly there, and I'll repeat what I said during the presentation about there are a lot of dimensions here that we didn't touch on in this in the brief document, the 10 things you should know about the energy water collision document, and I'll give some examples. If you think about water use for enhanced oil recovery, so where we take water and we inject it in oil wells, that has that's sort of a whole new dimension of the energy water collision. So as you look on the solution side, certainly there are issues. So rainwater catchment is certainly a potential option. I will point out that it's apparently not legal in some states. States that have different parts of the country have different ways that they manage their water resources or manage the water rights. And so in some of those, you get these odd counterintuitive and counterproductive rules that wouldn't even allow you to collect rainwater. So yes, it's definitely part of the palette of solutions that we should be drawing from, but there may be regulations that stand in the way.
The next question. Do you have an estimate of gallons of water consumed per kilowatt hour generated? They didn't specify at which site.
So I'll say for plants that are using once through cooling, they're withdrawing something like, so say a coal plant would be 20 to 50 gallons per kilowatt hour. Consumption would be a small piece of that. If you look at consumption in a closed loop system, you could be talking about something like 2 billion gallons of water per year for a coal plant, say a 600 megawatt coal plant. So it's going to depend. Sarah was mentioning the consumption at the Vogtle plants, the proposed Vogtle plants. They could go with once through cooling. Obviously, that's not an option anymore. But a once through cooling system would mean they'd consume less, but they would be withdrawing, 100 times as much as they would otherwise be doing. So there is a trade-off there.
I was going to say that the DOE report that I mentioned earlier that John said there'll be a link to within the 10 Things You Need to Know report, it does provide the gallons per megawatt hours of energy for withdrawal and consumption for the different resource types. And I've seen other charts here and there, but the general trend is your more traditional, coal and nuclear, fossil fuels, you'll see those as having a higher water intensity, more gallons used per kilowatt hour compared to renewables. And it also depends on your state, the makeup of your power supply within your state. So it will vary based on where you are and who your energy supplier is and what their energy mix is.
But it is on the just to give a little more specific. It's on the order of several hundred gallons of consumption per megawatt hour. The funny thing is that there is that chart in the Department of Energy report and subsequent reports. There was a good report that came out from the GAO last year. But there's actually ambiguity or disagreement about how much these plants actually withdraw and consume, and that has to do with the reporting requirements and compliance with reporting requirements by power plants and utilities. So we don't, the folks are using what information is available and using their best guess and doing the thermodynamic analyses, but that's one thing that we and others are trying to get a better handle on, is figuring out just what are those figures, just so we can really have a more solid sense of the magnitude of the challenge.
The next question. I've been told by a resident of Burke County who is a former state legislator and a judge in Georgia that the water table in Burke County is quite low, and that is one reason why there are few plants that depend on water throughout this large agrarian county, such as poultry.
Well, I can take that. There are some serious concerns with groundwater use in that area of the state of Georgia. Burke County is where the new proposed Vogtle reactors would be located if they're built, and they would have wells drilled not for cooling water purposes, but for sort of potable water uses and other specific things they need on site. It's much, much less. I mean, it's, I think, a million gallons a day or something like that than what the surface water use would be. But it is a concern. Local residents, et cetera, have been attending public meetings and bringing concerns up that they're concerned that their private wells will be affected by the drawdown from the plant. I think another real-world example of this would be the proposed coal plant in Plant Washington near Sandersville. It's a proposal by a group of EMCs, Power for Georgians, and they're proposing to actually drill 16 new wells so that they would use groundwater use during droughts. That's not in Burke County, but Washington County isn't far away, and there are serious issues with that. And when you think about it, I mean, in times of drought, using farmers or agriculture as an example, if they're relying on surface water and then groundwater as well, you know, having a big old power plant with 16 straws going down into the aquifer to pull water out because they're dealing with surface water limitations because of drought, I mean, that's a huge problem. So I think the Plant Washington proposal certainly has an Achilles heel with groundwater and how that's going to affect the surrounding community and surrounding needs that rely on groundwater.
In the report,
just in general, groundwater is an issue, and again, not one we really touched on here, but one that it's a whole other dimension of the problem. It's much less regulated, and it's a serious issue. You look at the High Plains aquifer across much of the Great Plains or underneath much of the Great Plains, and water drawdown for agriculture, but also for power plants, and if you try to overlay on that new power plants relying on that groundwater, then you see another. We certainly hope people see another dimension of the energy water collision there.
Thank you. In the report you were speaking of earlier, is there a comparison metric of gallons used per kilowatt hour generated by coal versus a nuclear plant?
Yes. So it's broken up those different reports we mentioned have coal, have natural gas, combined cycle, or simple ones, combustion turbine, or nuclear. They, as Sarah mentioned, they have renewable energy technologies on there. So it's all broken up, and it's broken up by these different types of cooling technologies, whether it's once through or the closed loop with, say, the cooling towers or dry cooling. And there's some of that information also on our website, and this is where the 10 things document can also be found. If you go to ucsusa.org/energy-water, then you can see some links to pages that talk a little bit more about the mechanics of why power plants use water at all. You know, why are we even talking about water in the context of power plants? But then also have some of those figures, and then look at different technologies, and also look at, you know, another issue we haven't really talked about, but is that it's not just about the power plants; it's also about the upstream implications and the downstream. So upstream meaning where's the fuel coming from? Where if it's coal from mountaintop removal, for example, that has serious water implications, particularly water quality implications. If it's natural gas that's extracted through hydraulic fracturing, that has certainly at a local level can have serious water implications. Nuclear, whether it's the uranium mining or other issues. So there are all kinds of dimensions, a wide range of issues that come in when you're looking at the energy water nexus.
Thank you. Does UCS or SACE have good data about chemical contamination loading from coal and nuclear plants, particularly radionuclide concentration versus background in different cooling loops?
This is Sarah. I would say we can refer people to documents. For instance, you know, the reports that nuclear utilities have to provide to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that show sort of what their annual releases, you know, daily releases to air, water, land of radionuclides. And there are, you know, states that have environmental monitoring or have had environmental monitoring. Georgia is an example of a state that did a fairly robust radiation monitoring program, but due to some serious funding cuts over the years, that has been scaled way back. But in terms of sort of a ready-to-read table of information, I don't have that, but it's something we could, you know, show you how to get to the NRC and find those documents.
Yeah, and I'll say from UCS's perspective, I'm not sure if we have things that specific. We certainly talk about those. Nuclear and coal are two technologies that we focus a lot on, so there is information on our website about different dimensions. For example, nuclear, looking at incidents by power plant of leakage, for example, with tritium leaking into the water, into nearby water sources, that sort of thing, but maybe not in the table format that you're asking about.
And in terms of, there's been a lot of work done recently on coal ash, which is a serious public health and environmental issue, which we have a lot of information of that on our website and staff that have been tracking that. You know, it's sort of separate, I think, from what the question was about, but certainly the implications of coal plants and building more coal plants is, you know, what are you going to do with this nasty coal ash? And that has serious water implications for sure.
Next question. What are the water implications of new environmental controls for emissions reduction?
The ones that I had mentioned that were examples brought to my attention were carbon capture and sequestration, which is a way to deal with, obviously, sort of trying to keep more carbon dioxide from going into the atmosphere. I was told that could increase water consumption by 80 to 100%, depending on the technology and the power plant used, et cetera. And then also, to help with air quality, coal plants may be sort of retrofitted with flue gas desulfurization units, and that could increase water consumption by 10%. So in those two cases, one dealing with climate change, one dealing with improving air quality, there are water implications to that. John, do you have more?
No, I just add that, and once you take it, as Sarah said, you're the reason we do these things is to improve our air quality. Once you capture those pollutants instead of letting them go into the air, then you have to make sure that they don't subsequently get into the water supply, and that can be an issue. So there's the water quantity issue, as Sarah pointed out. There's also the water quality implications potentially.
Thank you. Next question. Have there been aquifer studies that would assist those fighting against the construction of Vogtle?
Well, this is Sarah again. There have been studies done. I mean, most of the studies that I know of were dealing with some of the tritium contamination. Tritium being a radioactive form of hydrogen that is released from operating power plants and other facilities such as the Department of Energy's Savannah River site, a big nuclear weapons complex that's just across the river from Plant Vogtle in South Carolina that has a major tritium production facility and has historically been the culprit of very high tritium releases over time. And there were studies to try to find out, you know, where was the tritium coming from, et cetera, done by the USGS and Department of Energy and others. If somebody wanted to get a hold of me after the call, I could do my best to see what documentation I could get you from that. Plant Vogtle thus far, and I think many people have heard about tritium releases from existing power plants out in Illinois, for example. There were leaky pipes and other things where tritium was getting released. That has now become a major issue across the country for existing nuclear plants. And in fact, if you go to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's website, which is just nrc.gov, G-O-V, and you put tritium in there, they actually have a tritium page talking about the different testing and other things they've been doing at power plants across the country where they have found leaks. So that would be another resource to turn to. I doubt that the NRC has done a specific aquifer study in and around Plant Vogtle.
And this is another instance in which the water side is potentially going to bring down some power plants. Just to follow up on that one, the Vermont Yankee plant has had issues with tritium leakage and is having a hard time getting state permission to renew its license, which is due up in a couple of years. That's one. The Indian Point nuclear plant on the Hudson in New York is supposed to be moving toward putting a cooling tower on and is resisting that, and the plant may shut down rather than go that route. So this is some serious stuff. This energy water nexus.
Thank you. Next question. Do wind or solar technologies need water to cool, for cooling, et cetera? And if so, what are the amounts of water needed?
So wind does not. There's some talk of using water for washing the blades. I don't know how much that happens with the larger turbines we have now. So we tend to talk about those as just being minimal. We don't say it's zero, but at least in terms of electricity production, it doesn't use water. For solar, if you're talking photovoltaic, solar electric technologies, you could wash the modules. You might use water, particularly in much larger facilities. You would use water to keep the dust off and improve the performance. For the concentrating solar plants that I mentioned in my talk, yes, yeah. I mean, you've got water for steam production, which is a small piece, and then you've got the water potentially for cooling that steam. Now, as I mentioned, newer plants, a plant that just broke ground last month in California, has elected to go with dry cooling. That has cost and efficiency implications. But if you're siting these in the Mojave Desert, that may be a good way to go. So you really want to look at those options.
The next question. What if any, are Georgia's requirements for alternative energy modes in the future?
This is Sarah. For Georgia, some of the biggest pieces of the energy pie that are less water intensive that should be pursued, that SAFE and our allies have been advocating for aggressively, are energy efficiency measures that would decrease demand. And also in terms of generation supplies, there is wind potential in Georgia. There is decent wind potential as well offshore, which is fairly exciting. There is certainly, the sun does shine in Georgia. I know there are some public service commissioners in Georgia who, as you know, have been quoted saying the wind don't shine and the sun don't blow in Georgia, but I can guarantee you the wind and sun blow and shine. There are also biopower opportunities in Georgia. They have significant forestry, agricultural residues that can be tapped. And depending on what technologies are put in place with those biopower facilities, you can see potentially some water benefits. But biopower as a whole is not as water saving as wind and solar.
And to put that in the national context, there are a majority of states, 29 states plus Washington, D.C., do have requirements for renewable energy for their utilities to increase their use of renewable energy. So Georgia does not happen to be one of those.
Yeah. Correct.
This particular listener offers another issue. Turkey Point Nuclear is proposing using wastewater for cooling, potentially dispersing pharmaceuticals and other contaminants through aerosol drift over Everglades and Biscayne. Do you have any comment on wastewater usage for cooling?
Well, I'm familiar with the Turkey Point concern. Probably the person sending that question in is maybe one of our fellow interveners as we challenge the application by Florida Power and Light to get an operating license to build two new reactors down near Miami off of Biscayne Bay. And there are concerns about what FPL is proposing to do there by using some of the wastewater, because you'd have vast, vast amounts of evaporative loss from this treated wastewater, which concerns about, as they said, pharmaceuticals and other things now being aerosolized and distributed in the air, I think is a serious issue that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has to study intently. And I also think, you know, a utility like Florida Power and Light is proposing something like that has not shown in its application that is necessarily safe. I think wastewater in general probably needs and is looked at on a site-by-site basis. But I don't know if John has anything more to add there.
No, it is an option that some plants have turned to. It is something you need to think about. It's potentially a way of reducing the pressures on local freshwater ecosystems and groundwater. But as Sarah points out, there are, you know, it's not a freebie. There are dimensions to it that you need to explore before going down that path.
Okay, this is going to be the final call for questions. If you have any questions, please submit them at this time. Next question. In response to the fact that wastewater and sewage treatments plants use high levels of electricity while emitting many GHG pollutants, what are some alternatives to traditional treatment technologies?
I'll admit that I focus more on the water implications of our energy choices. That's where our initiative is focused, rather than the energy implications of our water choices. So I could point folks toward resources. There are some organizations that are taking a good close look at that. I'll mention the Pacific Institute out in California. I would point you toward our 10 things document and the section, the footnotes associated with the section on that.
Okay, thank you. Sarah, you didn't mention any efforts being made to work with North Florida on water planning. Florida's Northern Water Management District are seeing our water tables drop, and water is migrating northeast towards Jacksonville and Atlanta. How do you see us reaching across political boundaries in this planning process?
That's an excellent question, because part of this water planning process in Georgia is happening because of the political realities between Alabama, Florida, and Georgia. And, you know, this water war, so to speak, has been going on for more than a decade, and, you know, has gone to Congress. The governors have all been involved. There are lawsuits. There are judges' orders. I don't know what it's going to take. I mean, I would say some of the generic things is that it's going to take visionary leadership from both the leaders of Georgia and Florida to work across state lines. And it's also, you know, one thing that is a uniting factor in that is, I'll point out, a utility, for instance, Southern Company, has subsidiaries in all three of those states: Alabama Power, Gulf Power in Florida, Georgia Power in Georgia. And they're sitting at the table in these negotiations, and they're certainly weighing in, and they certainly have their interests of needing water for their power plants. So I think another thing to say is that the energy implications of those states for those shared resources needs to look at the energy part of that in a major way, and also look around and see who's negotiating at these tables. You know, some of these are closed door meetings, and the public is not at them. And so it's hard to know whether the public's best interests on how best to use those state water resources being looked at. So again, I'd point back that I would hope with new governors in those states, they get serious and they look at this as a regional issue where real people are getting affected, and that special interests don't win out, which I think most of us are sensing that that's sort of what is happening. So I'm sorry that that's not a perfect answer, but if I could answer that question, I'd probably be President of the United States, because it's a pretty difficult question.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. The next question, thermoelectric plants that use municipally supplied water use their water more efficiently because it makes economic sense to do so. Why don't states simply charge power plants to withdraw water from public surface waters in the same way and at similar rates?
That is a great idea, and we actually we're working with allies, Western Resource Advocates out in Colorado. They have a paper that'll be coming out called The Value of Water, and there are some case studies in it, and one of them is actually on the Savannah River and Plant Vogtle, and sort of bringing that forward. If Georgia Power and its subsidiaries had to pay for the water that they're withdrawing from the Savannah River, what would that cost? Because, for instance, a downstream city like City of Savannah, who are getting shifted off the Floridan Aquifer and over to Savannah River water, they have to pay for their water. The industrial users down there that are buying water from the City of Savannah have to pay for it. And so what if Southern companies, Plant Vogtle Project, had to? You know, that would add to the cost. So, again, I think the question there is hitting the nail on the head, that if you associate a cost with these things for utilities, they would potentially look at the bottom line and realize that there are other supply options that do not have those costs associated with them. But unfortunately, for the most part right now, new power plant proposals are kind of getting free water. I mean, they have to put in the infrastructure in many cases, but they just stick a straw in the aquifer and the surface water, and they're pulling it. So,
next question. Are there federal plans for any aquifer studies that look both at SRS reactors, current and past, and nuclear plant Vogtle impacts?
I would just say I don't know if the person who wrote that question was on earlier, but I don't know about upcoming studies that will be done, given that the Savannah River site is incredibly polluted and contaminated. It has hundreds of individual Superfund sites on it, and it's not getting cleaned up or remediated at the pace that it needs to. There is going to be a lot of analysis being done on the aquifers in that area for long-term contamination by not only radioactive materials, but a lot of heavy metals and pretty nasty chemicals. But I couldn't give the person who answered that question a specific, you know, next year such and such a report is coming out. I'm not sure. But feel free to email me afterwards. I do have allies probably that are on the phone that track SRS pretty closely who may have some information to share with you.
Sarah, can you just tell folks what SRS is?
Oh, the Savannah River site, the Department of Energy Nuclear Weapons Complex, that's right across the river from Plant Vogtle, right across the Savannah River in South Carolina.
And this is the final question. Why are there budget cuts on regulation and not on nuclear ramping up?
That's another one that Sarah's
going to pick. I figured that would be a good one to end this with.
When she becomes president, she'll take care of that.
Right.
Yeah, there are lots of questions about why we do things the way we do when it comes to nuclear. So that's just, you know, water is one of many dimensions. You know, our blindness to subsidies might be another, or inattention to other important details. No, it's a great question. I don't have the answer for you.
Well, thank you both, John and Sarah. And I would like to thank everybody who stayed on the line and everyone who had to go for attending today. We are very excited about our webinar series. We wish you all a happy new year and hope that you'll join us in January. And with that, we hope you have a great afternoon, and please feel free to visit our website, www.cleanenergy.org, where you can take action, become a member, and view past webinars like the one you participated in today. Thank you for your support, and we look forward to hearing from you. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
All.